Board Game Bros.
Hello, listeners.
Hey, people.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. And today we got a regularly scheduled weekly episode coming at you. We are going to pick one board game. We're going to talk about how to play it. We're going to talk about the strategies involved in the game. And then we're going to talk about the design of the game. So, Matthew, what game are we talking about today?
We are talking about Santorini, designed by Gordon Hamilton and published in 2016. But the one we're talking about is a remake of a version published in 2004. The original was completely abstract, and this remake has more thematic elements.
Right, and we'll definitely get into those thematic elements
right now, soon. I guess.
Right now. Well, in my short description, I actually don't have any of the thematic flavor aesthetic elements to it, because this is a abstract game, which means that the rules for it are fairly simple. And in my simplified explanation, I take it one step further. So what is Santorini? In Santorini, players take turns moving workers and building towers block by block. You win when you move a worker on top of the third level of a tower. That's the short of it. But it gets a little more complicated when we start talking about the details of how to play. So let's get into those details now. So first of all, at the start of the game, each player has two workers that they place in turn order, I suppose, on a board. And that board is it 5x5 or 7x7?
Let me check real quick. I have the rule book right here. It is 5x5.
5x5. So they put their workers on a 5x5 board anywhere they want. One player places two of their workers, and then the other player places two of their workers. And then play begins, starting with the person who first placed their workers. So on your turn, you have to do two things. You have to move your worker, and only one worker, so you pick one of your two workers to move. And then the worker that moves builds. And when you build, you just select a square surrounding that worker, any of the eight squares surrounding that worker, and you build a block or a dome in that square. But the block or dome that you build depends on what has already been built there. If there's nothing built in that square already, then you start by building the ground level block. If there is a ground level block, you build the second level block, then the third level block, then you can build the dome on top of the third level block. Also, there's a couple restrictions for when you're moving, just as there are restrictions for how you build. A unit or a worker can move up on top of blocks, but only one level up. So if they're on the ground level, they can move up to the first level. If they're on the first, they can move up to the second. Workers can also move down, but a worker can move down any number of blocks. So even if a worker is standing on the second or third level, they can jump all the way down. One more movement restriction is that a worker cannot move into an occupied space, and a space is occupied if there is another worker in it, such as your own or your opponent's workers. And a unit cannot move into a space with a dome, because a dome occupies a space.
Yes.
So if you'll remember, I said that in the short description, the way you win is by moving a worker up onto the third level of a tower. So this game is all about building towers on this map and being the first player to put your worker on top of that third level. But also, like I said, you can build domes on top of the third levels, and that's essentially a way of preventing your opponents from winning,
right?
By stopping them from reaching that third level.
You can build onto any height of a level, regardless of how high or low your worker is, as long as you're neighboring that tile. So even if you're on the ground, you can put a dome on top of the third floor.
Mm-hmm.
There is one more rule, which is that if you cannot move or build on your turn, then you lose.
Yes. I believe in a multiplayer game, it's a little more nuanced than that. It's that if a unit cannot move or build at all, they are removed from the board.
Yeah.
And then if that happens with both of your units, then you lose.
Yeah, there's some slight differences between 3 and 4 players, but other than that. Yes.
And how you would encounter that situation is if your unit was, say, surrounded on all sides by two-level towers, which you cannot climb on top of.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's it again. And sometimes my short descriptions for a game will go that long, and that won't be all. But for this game, that is all. At least before you add the god cards.
Right.
So this game has a Greek theme. You're building these beautiful white towers, and the Greek gods will give you special abilities when you play this game. At the start of the game, you can select a Greek god card to use for the rest of the game that will give you some form of bonus ability or some restrictions to your opponent in some cases. I wrote down some categories for these god abilities, so just to go over them. Gods can usually fall into one of these five categories in terms of what their ability does, and that is they could give you extra moves or builds. They could restrict your opponent's movements. They can displace your opponents, which means they could, say, move them around when it's not their turn against their will. They can remove pieces from the board, sometimes blocks from towers, sometimes your opponent's workers. And sometimes they will give you alternative win conditions, so ways to win other than standing on the third level of a tower. Yep. The game suggests that for your first few playthroughs, that you do not use these cards, but then after you get comfortable with the rules of the game, it encourages you to include these cards to shake up how things play out.
And they even have a separate list of simple and advanced gods, so it also recommends using only simple gods for your first few simple gods.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's basically it for how to play. Mm-hmm. So I guess let's get into strategy.
Yeah.
And where do you start? Because this is an abstract game, like chess or Go or, you know, what have you. So that means that the strategy to this game is like a fountain flowing. It's deep and wide.
Right. It's similar to those games, too. I think the key thing is having an idea of who is the one that gets to ask the questions and who has to answer the opponent. Yes, so picture it like this. The player who goes first, if they do one thing and the player goes second does the exact same thing and they both try to win as fast as possible, the player who goes first will win.
Mm-hmm.
So the second player wants to try and stop them from doing that and find a timing gap where they can switch it over in their favor. The player who goes first wants to prevent that from happening or take it back if that does happen.
Sure. In Go, there is a concept called sentai, which is, it's basically this concept where one player is sort of has the initiative and they're making the moves, and the other player is forced to react to those moves. But in Go and in this game, there are ways to shift that around so that the person who was reacting now gets a chance to act, and the opponent who was acting must now react.
Right, yeah. The simplest of these ways is putting a cap on a tower, or putting a dome on a tower. Because, so the thing about the tower is you need to go from a level 2 to a level 3 after you build the level 3, which means you need two level 2s at the minimum, and then usually a level 1 to have gone from the floor up. So that is like, first off, that's like 6 turns just to build the whole structure, give or take. I mean, you could go 5 turns probably, but still. But then if you put a dome on the tower, then they have to spend another 3 turns to build up another tower all the way. Not to mention they have to still move, which can have some other complications.
Yeah, because they no longer have the tower, they may have to move down and around and climb back up.
Right. And since you have two workers, you can have one worker that's near their tower so that like you have that option available while still building up a separate area for yourself.
Right. You could, as long as your worker is close enough, if they take 6 turns and nearly finish their tower, you can take 5 turns to start to finish a tower but not get as close, and then on the sixth turn you cap their tower, and then if they don't have a worker close to you, then you take your seventh turn finishing your tower and your eighth turn winning.
Yeah.
So so because of that, now your opponent has to sort of set that same situation that you had set up, where you're both building towers and you both have workers near the other tower to cap it in order to flip that initiative around.
Right.
But then it just keeps going from there. How the strategy expands.
Mm-hmm.
So like, how do you, I think the next thing that's important to know in, or keep in mind in strategy is a worker's reach, I guess, is one way of calling it.
Yeah.
So in the situation we just described, this was assuming that the opponent had a worker in the area of the tower you were building to that was like poised in position to cap it off. And a worker's reach is essentially just two squares away from the worker in any direction, because they can move in any direction and then build on the next square. But it's not always going to be that in a game. As obstacles and elements are added to the board, a worker's reach can be limited and sections of it can be cut out. So being aware of a worker's reach is important, because if you can finish a tower or build the third level of a tower outside of an opponent's reach, then they cannot cap it on their next turn, and that means that you are guaranteed to seize it with your own worker.
Yes.
So both being aware of your opponent's reach and understanding where the blind spots are, and also being aware of your own reach and understanding where the blind spots are important, because if your opponent starts to build outside of your reach in your blind spots, then you need to move your workers to cover those spaces.
Right.
And then at the same time, take advantage of when your opponents leave openings.
Right, yeah.
You could even think of it a space further, and say, like, what about two turns away? So you could start the process of building your tower far enough away that even if your opponent had two turns to respond, they couldn't make it.
Right. Let's see. Another thing is that, so you can't move up two tiles or more, or two blocks or more. And this means that you can sort of create a wall just by building up a tower to its second level. Now, what's interesting is you can go, you can move through corners, so you can move from like one square to the square, diagonal from it down a corner. But that means if two like level two blocks are sort of on touching each other's corners, you can slip through that gap. So a solid wall has to be completely touching the other blocks in the wall.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing about that is that you can block part of that with a worker. This is pretty useful as well if the worker is still in, like, a threatening zone for your opponent. So, like, you can on one hand block the opponent from getting near your other worker, and on the other hand, you have it ready to put a dome on something.
Right, by having your worker be, like, the third segment in that wall.
Yeah.
As long as that wall is close to whatever your opponent is doing, yeah, they're poised and in position to take advantage of it.
And so
you also have to be careful with walls, though, because with the, you know, this idea of tempo, if you spend some time building a wall and your opponent spends some time building a tower, then if you end up with all of your pieces on your side of the wall and all the opponent's pieces on their side of the wall, and you spend all this time building a tower or building a wall, and they spend all the time actually trying to win, then they're going to win because you just walled yourself off from them.
Right.
So you want to make sure that when you build the wall, you are either leaving that little gap, like with the worker there, so that you can move into position, or you're building the wall in such a way that your opponent's, you know, movements are restricted so much that they cannot actually build the tower.
Yeah. If your opponent is building up, you can also try to steal the third level from them, or make it so that they don't want to build the third level. So, like, if you see your opponent and there's, you know, you think they're trying to build up towards the win, you can just place one block down and then jump onto a second level when it opens up as they're moving around.
So now we're sort of getting into, until now, we've really been talking about both players building independent towers, and then trying to stop the other one from building that tower. That's sort of like the strategy dynamic we've been discussing until now, but now we're starting to get into what if both players are trying to build the same tower.
Yeah.
So in that case, there's, I think the biggest thing is being above your opponents.
Yeah.
And keeping your movement options open. I think because if you're in proximity to each other, then you no longer have to worry about the range of pieces and being close enough to cap something off, because usually you're always there. So then you have to realize, like, how do you win? How do you think you win when you're building in proximity to one another? And I think one part of that is trying to be at least in the lead, height-wise, because you have to be on the second level to get up to the third level. So if you're already on the second level, then you have an advantage.
Right. Also, this is a point where body blocking is much better, because you don't have the ability to wall off sections with blocks. So if you can, like, move another worker so that your opponent can't get to the third level when you build it, or they can't get to the second level just in general, then you can make much better use of having both workers close together, or just make better use of having both workers. Because, I mean, you have two workers, so ideally you'd want to be using both of them to their best ability, or right. else it's almost like you're handicapping yourself.
Right. So that's... So in the shared tower scenario, what is it again that you try to do with both workers?
At least try to use one to body block the opponent, so that, since you can't build walls otherwise. Mm.
And in the two towers scenario, it's sort of like one worker is building the tower, the other worker is interrupting your opponent's building.
Yeah.
In a shared tower scenario, you could also kind of think of it as like your one worker is sharing the tower with your opponents. Sometimes they're body blocking, sometimes they're capping, sometimes they're positioning themselves to steal the third level from your opponent. And then the other worker could also just be building a tower on its own.
Yeah.
So if both of your opponent's workers are building one tower and you're interrupting it with one worker, your other worker could just be building. This is sort of like another, this is almost like a two tower scenario, but in this situation, your one worker isn't just trying to interrupt your opponent. They're also trying to just steal the tower from them.
Right. Yeah. These two tower scenarios are both a little riskier because your opponent's right next to you, so they have more room to jump in and cap things.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have the worker lead, then it is also much better because, yeah, you are essentially able to make every worker build something important and threaten something every turn or every other turn.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about... So when we talk about towers... you know, usually we just think of like the two or three square towers, you know, towers that whose proportions only take up three of the squares on the board that you're just kind of hopping between to make it all the way up to the top.
Mm-hmm.
But I find that the more dangerous and effective mm-hmm. towers end up being very wide.
Mm-hmm.
So, instead of like hopping back and forth and going like up one level, you know, make a step up the other level, make a step up to the third level. Lots of games will play out with just people hopping around and making a bunch of two level towers. And this is a pretty good strategy because if you don't make the third tower, then you don't give your opponent that chance to take the sente away from you, take the initiative away from you and cap that third tower. Because like we said, when they cap the tower, now they're in control.
Right.
So if you never give them the tower to cap, then they never can take that control away from you. Now, if you're never making the third tower, that also means that there's not much for them to respond to. They can kind of do whatever they want sometimes. But right. by making all of these level two towers, what you're doing is you're giving yourself a whole lot of options for when you do go for that third level. And those options will be, you know, a mixture of inside and outside of the threat range of your opponents, or they might be in places where after they're capped, they make a wall. Like your opponent is kind of forcing themselves to build a wall that you can then use on your turn to build another tower, which they can no longer reach because they just capped the tower.
Yeah.
And that is no longer an accessible space.
Also, I want to bring up that if you make a shape in a 2x2 square of second level towers, then if your opponent has one worker that's touching one of the tiles of that tower, there will be one square that they can't actually impact at all. So like, this is one of the safer ways to prevent somebody from capping your tower is making a 2x2 section, because like the tower that's on the opposite corner of where your opponent is safer.
I've also seen a V shape as being pretty effective at this sort of scenario, and having your piece sort of in the middle of that V shape of like three towers, because usually your opponent's worker will be, either they'll be on one side, and so you can, you know, force them to react on that side and then move to the other side, which is two spaces away from that tower and likely inaccessible by the worker that stopped your first attempt, or the worker might be like at the tip of the V. And you can force them to move to one side, and then they won't be able to move back to the other side to stop you from reaching the top of that tower.
Yeah. A lot of right angles are good in sort of that regard.
Mm-hmm.
Or just two diagonals and then one adjacent. I don't know how to put it other than an R shape. No, not really an R shape. But that's another one where, like, it's a long line that is hard to go from one end to the other.
Mm-hmm. So because having all of these two-height towers near each other is a dangerous thing, now your opponent is forced to figure a way to defend those. So that could mean just spending a bunch of turns climbing the tops of those towers, you know, probably wasting block placements because they don't want to put the third level on top of a two level tower to have you cap it. Or to have you take it and win. So they're just kind of climbing those blocks of towers to get to the top, throwing their blocks to the sides when they have to build, just so that they can be up there and in position for whatever you attempt to do. And they might have to move both workers in that place just to, you know, cover both sides of, like, say, a long stretch of these two block high towers.
Right. And then you force the opponent into putting it into a shared tower scenario where you're on top.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they have to get up there first.
Yeah. They place to get up there can be used to develop the tower even more.
Yeah, so, yeah. I mean, they have to place a one block and then climb up it and then climb up to the next one. You just got to place another block on top of that. At that point, I think it just becomes like this weird joust where both players are just kind of angling and positioning for supremacy over this cluster of two block towers.
Right.
And I think the easiest way to do that in this case, I think it might be in your. I guess one way of forcing your opponent to leave the tower is by trying to build a tower at the end that you're occupying, because it might be a case where you both have a worker on top of these towers and a worker that's not on top of the towers yet. That's probably a common scenario, at least when this thing starts to develop. So you can just start building a tower near the worker you have up there and further away from where your opponent has a worker. And that would mean that either That usually would mean that they have to use their ground worker, or they have to hop down with their upper worker to cap the tower that you drop like a third level on top of. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so because of that, now you're in control.
Yeah.
And now you can, you know, work on the other side. You sort of forced your opponent to one side. Now you can work on it. Maybe. I don't know. It gets a little blurry there because we've only played this game about a half dozen times.
Mm-hmm.
And with abstract games like this, the strategy is just this constant developing of, you know, this is my strategy, I'm going to win this way, and then figuring out, like, okay, this is how that strategy is countered, this is how the counter strategy is countered, and so on and so forth for forever.
Right.
And so this is about as far as we've gotten, at least this is about as far as I've gotten in that process. Like, this is how X person X wins, so this is what person Y does, and this is what person Y wins, this is what person X does.
Yeah. By the way, so do you want to go and talk about gods real quick before we go into the design?
Sure.
Okay, so, I think there, so it suggests drafting gods by, like, placing a god face up for every player and then players choosing one god at a time, starting from the left of the starting player. And it should be noted that gods are recommended to be used in 3 and 4 player games, mainly. You can use them in 2 players, but, like, they're basically required for the 3 and 4 players. So some gods are stronger in multiplayer, some gods are probably stronger in 2 player. But in general, I think there's definitely a few that have stood out for us. I want to go ahead and first start off with Atlas.
Oh, yeah. Atlas is one of my favorites.
Yeah. Atlas says that when you build, your worker may build a dome at any level. So we found that in a strict 1v1 setting with one worker each, Atlas wins every time.
Mm-hmm.
Because nothing can be built on top of the dome, and your opponent can't move on the dome. So it's really easy to corner your opponent by just building domes around them.
Mm-hmm.
And threaten and forcing them to either, like, try and get the win now or move away, which is usually hard for anybody to do outside of Atlas. So Atlas is, like, one of the strongest at making people lose by being unable to move or build.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, that's one of the big standouts, I think.
At least from the basic gods, or from the simple gods.
Yeah.
Atlas is very powerful. Artemis is, or not Artemis, Athena is not as oppressive as Atlas, but can have some very important tempo advantages, because Athena states that if one of your workers moved up on your last turn, opponent's workers cannot move up on their turn. Yeah. And moving up is a critical, you know, facet to this game.
That's how you win.
That's how you win. So if you were to move up and then your opponent was in position to take the victory, they could not.
Yeah.
It gives you an extra turn. And this extra turn can happen multiple times. Now, like we said, having multiple towers is a good thing. And Athena will just sort of force your opponents to do that. They won't be able to move up and start working on the next level. They'll just have to spread out a couple units or a couple blocks across a large area and then eventually move up on them and then spread out some more blocks and then eventually move up on them. But yeah. Hopefully at that point, your your Athena has, you know, sort of positioned themselves in a pretty threatening way.
Yeah. Another of the basic gods that I think is good is Pan. We didn't get a whole lot of playtime with Pan, but his win condition seems to be one of the easiest ones to satisfy, which is you win if your worker moves down 2 or more levels.
Yeah.
So that doesn't even require you to get to the 3rd level, even built it. You have to just move to the 2nd level and then move down to any of the neighboring spaces.
Right. And with Pan, it's almost like required that you be building in the same tower as your opponent. And like, if your opponent's building in the middle of the board, you need to just spend every move, like, building up the area surrounding the opponent's tower so that they don't get that chance.
Yeah.
It seems, which is super restrictive. Hephaestus was also pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Because it says your worker may build one additional block on top of your first block. So if you're going for that scenario where you have a bunch of two-level blocks all clustered next to each other to give you a bunch of options for finishing out the game, Hephaestus is the best at that. Hephaestus is the best at that.
I was going to say, Hephaestus is the bestest.
Yeah, he's the bestest at setting up that scenario.
Yeah.
Honestly, Demeter isn't bad either. She lets you build an additional time, just not in the same block. But since you need at least two towers, you know, built up in order to finish the game, because you need a second level tower next to your third level tower that you can move up onto, then Demeter makes that tower building process faster.
Yeah.
Like, the restriction actually isn't really a restriction.
Yeah.
Okay. What about advanced gods? There's one particularly that stood out to me, and that was, or two of them actually. Those were Charon and Hypnus.
Right. So, Charon says that before your worker moves, if a neighboring opponent worker can be moved, you can flip them to this space directly on the opposite side of the worker you're moving.
Right. So you just kind of flip them over you, as long as the space on the opposite side is empty.
Yeah.
This is pretty powerful, just because, like, if you're in a scenario where you're working in very close quarters against one another, moving somebody two spaces away is a huge deal. Like we said, two spaces is that worker range.
Mm-hmm.
And so essentially the tower that you're building, if you flip a unit, most of the tower is now out of their range, so they cannot affect it. So you can build your tower now in peace.
Yeah.
Even if they move, like, you can move the worker that flips and flip them again, you know, in a future turn, or you could just keep them there. Like, as long as you're just kind of sitting there, all those eight spaces surrounding you are now spaces that your opponent needs to be careful to enter, because they might just get flipped.
Yeah.
The other one, Hypnus, says that if one of your opponent's workers is higher than all of their others, it cannot move. So that means that if you want to win the game, then you need to have both of your workers on the second level.
Yeah.
And this is super restrictive.
Yeah, it's already kind of difficult to get a one worker in place on the second level, but then just having to have both on level two before you can actually place the tower,
mm-hmm.
it takes at least a few extra turns to build up the space to move up and then move up.
Yeah, it seems like a game with Hypnus is only won by, like we said, that part where you cap the tower, which takes the tempo away from the person who is, you know, has that initiative and gives you the initiative. You have to do that, like, multiple times with Hypnus in order to actually seize that initiative and position yourself to win.
Yeah.
At least that's what it seems like, because you have to take so many turns getting your workers up to a level where you can actually win.
Yeah.
Until you don't, then your opponent has no reason to react to you.
Let's see. Other cool ones include Bia, who is, you always place your workers first, but then on your turn, if your worker moves into a space and the next space directly in front of it has an opponent's worker, that opponent's worker is removed from the game.
Mm-hmm.
So Bia is the king of forcing moves, because you basically move Bia into a space and say, if your opponent doesn't move out of that, then that worker will get off the board, mm-hmm. which means that, you know, they'll either be able to do less options or they'll lose.
If you're familiar with chess, Bia can also fork, which is a chess term that means you are threatening two different pieces. And since your opponent can only make one move on their turn, then they likely cannot save both of them. So
yeah.
If you can ever fork your opponent's pieces with a worker as Bia, you're guaranteed to remove one. And that is just a huge change in the game. We talk about this during worker placement games, how useful it is to have multiple workers. And the same thing is true here.
Yeah.
If you're only down to one, then the biggest thing is their range is much smaller. So mm-hmm. you cannot affect huge portions of the board where your opponent can just either spend some time building up a wall to really keep you out of it, or can just start building, and by the time you get there, it's too late.
Yeah. Lemus is also interesting, because Lemus says that your opponent's workers cannot build on spaces neighboring your workers unless they're building a dome to create a complete tower.
Right.
So, for one thing, Lemus is the direct counter to Atlas, because it can only place a dome to create a complete tower.
Right.
But also just the fact that, like, your worker stops the opponents from building up just by existing. And since that is like a 8x8 space around the worker that doesn't exist, and the board has 25 spaces on it, theoretically there could be like 8 spaces at most or so that aren't affected by Lemus at any given moment. Or even 6 maybe. I don't know the math exactly, but yeah. Which just really limits where the opponent can actually build and gives you a lot of territory, a lot of space, a lot of range.
Mm-hmm.
And then Persephone is the other one I wanted to bring up from the Advanced Gods. Persephone says, on the opponent's turn, if possible, at least one of their workers must move up. So it forces the opponent to move up if they're able to.
Mm-hmm.
Which often means that, like, either the opponent, like, needs to be really careful about how they're building up. Because if they, like, just move a worker and then place a block on the same level, then... or on the same level so that they would go up one higher next turn, then they have to. And then Persephone has, like... The player with Persephone has a clear idea of where that player is going to be building next. So, like, it just makes your next turns kind of obvious.
Right. If you're playing Persephone, what you want to do is build that shared tower in the center of the board. Mm-hmm. But then use that ability to force your opponents away from them eventually.
Yeah. It should be noted that in 4-player, it is a team of 2v2. And players on the same team take alternating turns. So, like, if me and Jeffrey were on a team, it would be me, opponent A, Jeffrey, opponent B, me. And the gods that are active during the opponent's turn are really good because they are always active instead of the ones just on your turn, which are only active when it's you directly whose turn it is.
One of the 4 turns will have your god, but 2 of the 4 turns will be affected by your god if they affect opponents.
Yeah.
The last god that I want to point out is one that we didn't get a chance to play with, but sounds very powerful, and that is Medusa.
Mm-hmm.
And Medusa says that at the end of your turn, if possible, your workers build in lower neighboring spaces that are occupied by opponents' workers, removing the opponents' workers from the game. So you turn people to stone by standing above them. And I think this is just good for similar reasons to why Bia is good, and that's just because removing workers from the board is a very, very powerful thing. Bia's effect is just a little like easier to set up and more threatening. I think Medusa's having to move up above an opponent's worker could be a little harder to set up.
Yeah.
But still just as powerful. They're still just as dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so let's talk about the design, shall we?
All right, yeah. So, Santorini is an abstract game. Mm. And so, the idea of an abstract game is generally that it is a game where the theme is either non-existent or has very little to do with the actual mechanics outside of, like, slight theming, like how in chess, you know, the knight acts like a knight in battle by flanking people. Or in Hive, the grasshopper jumps over stuff. In Santorini, without the god cards, there is pretty much no direct theme.
Right.
So it fits that aspect of an abstract game. But the Santorini... like many abstract games, are designed around, like we said, a sort of tempo change, a tug of war almost.
Mm-hmm.
And generally this is sort of a consequence of how abstract games generally work, because both players have open information and they have the same options. And so how do you like change it up so that one player can overcome the other in some way? You know, right. We sort of mentioned that at the start of the design of the strategy discussion, but when designing an abstract game, that's really important to consider. And so, of course, like we mentioned, there's the whole putting the dome on the third level, which is both really quick for one player to do instead of building up a tower. But it's like a very telegraphed counterplay.
Mm-mm. It's important that, you know, the opponent does something, then you do something, then the opponent does something. So what do you do that can stop them? And in this game, what you do is you build that dome. Right. That's sort of like the crucial moment, is like that, like, I'm about to win, what do you do? And the abstract games with, you know, abstract games need there to be something that the opponent can do in that moment to win.
Right, yeah.
Or at least to prolong the game.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, not win.
Yeah.
Stop the win.
And so one thing that's nice about this sort of way to stop somebody to win is... for one thing, like, it is super efficient, and it is clearly telegraphed by both, like, the blue color of the domes and just the shape of them, you mm-hmm. know, and the size and all that. And so, like, when you're designing a game like this, you want at least one option to be obvious to new players so that they get some sort of idea of, like, oh, this is some, like, basic counterplay.
Yeah.
You know, like, this is strategy that is really easy to figure out. Like, even the first time your opponent builds their third level and you can't move on it, you're gonna try to place a dome, and if you do place a dome, you'll see how good it is immediately. So, like, having an obvious counterplay from the start kind of keys in players that there is... a tighter design and tighter strategy allowed, mm-hmm. and it's kind of a hook, because now that happens, both players know that they have to try to set up a situation for them to win instead of mm-hmm. just tunnel visioning from it for the start. So both of those kind of get the player involved in the offensive and defensive planning for the game.
It also helps that the third level is so differently shaped than the second and first levels of a tower.
The second and first are like these cubes almost.
Yeah, if we're talking about, you know, how components are designed to appear. Yeah, the first and second levels are cubes. The third level is like a ring of columns with like a platform on top of them, and you stand on that platform to win. It almost looks like a crown.
Yeah.
That's very intentional because... You know, I mean, it looks all right sitting underneath the round dome piece, this like round third tier. It could have just as easily been a cube, but because it's this like very intricate, very differently designed piece, it really stands out. It makes you want to stand on top of it, and it makes it obviously stand out for when your opponent places it. You know, if they were a cube, there might be some games where somebody puts it down and you just kind of disregard it because it's like Connect Four, like mm-hmm. three discs. It doesn't pop out to you, you know, if you just play it for fun or whatever.
Yeah,
I guess professional Connect Four people will be like, three discs are like burned into their memory. Yeah. But you know, to a casual person, you could totally miss three discs in a row and disregard them. In this game, you cannot ignore the third tower because it's so different from all the other components.
There's something really weird about how, since it's like this open columnal piece, it almost lets more light into it, because like the other pieces do have kind of holes in them like doors and windows,
mm-hmm.
but they're overall just a bit darker, but it does feel like there's a contrast when somebody places the third level.
Mm-hmm.
But But like, so part of the importance of telegraphing things like this is because if you aren't aware of the counterplay in really any strategy game, then it doesn't seem fair. Like, why would you replay a game where you don't know why you lost? And especially abstract games that are like quick games that are meant to be played multiple times, ideally. You know, that's sort of like a cardinal sin, is not wanting people to replay it again.
And so, I was going to talk about how the best abstract games, in my opinion, are ones where you're constantly developing strategies for them.
Yeah.
And this game is no different than that. You know, it starts like, I mean, we went through the whole process when we were in our strategy discussion of this kind of evolution of strategy that happens as you start to examine the game. We talked about how if you build two towers independent, you know, the person who goes first will win. So now you send a guy over there to cap it. Now you will win. So they send a guy over to cap you. Now who wins? You know, maybe nobody wins in that case. So you need to start getting even more creative. So you start, you know, building multiple towers, and then you start fighting over multiple towers. And now you're building a shared tower, and it just goes on and on and on in all these different iterations and versions. And that's the most exciting part about a strategy game. Like you said, this can only exist if people are playing the game multiple times. You don't want it to be where one person develops a strategy, the other player loses to it, and then that's it.
Yeah.
Like, they don't want to play anymore. You want it to be like one person just develops a strategy and it works out, so that either the opponent tries that strategy, or the opponent figures out how to counter it, and you just continue from there.
Yeah.
The one thing that you want to try to avoid is blunders. Because a blunder feels very bad. When you blunder, that means that you did something that will lose you the game. And in some cases, a blunder can happen very early on in the game. And in some cases, you may not know that that blunder happened. Mm-hmm. In this game, I remember making a tower very early on in one of the times that I played. And then that tower ended up being an obstacle that I couldn't move around, because it towered is an impassable thing. A completed tower is impassable. You have to walk around it. And because of that, I couldn't reach somebody who was completing a tower.
Yeah.
That was a blunder. And it felt bad personally, but it wasn't awful, I guess. I think it was just sort of like it ended up being important on like the very last turn.
Yeah.
I think, which was okay.
Yeah, I think this game does a good job of, like, when you make a blunder, it's kind of obvious what it was, at least once the game is done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, oh, you shouldn't have capped off that tower because now you're less mobile, or you should have been closer to that space so you can, you know, you can defend it,
mm-hmm.
or you shouldn't have gotten cornered as much, stuff like that.
Right. Although, after having done that, I played two more games later on where I tried to use that sort of mechanic to my advantage. I tried to make a barricade with a completed tower, and then use that barricade to my advantage. The first time I tried it, it didn't work. But then the second time it did work, and it felt really cool. And yeah. So that was interesting.
Yeah.
And how the game is designed to do that, I don't know. It's just a good abstract game, because that kind of thing can happen.
Yeah.
It's sort of more like a consequence of the design than a design decision.
Yeah. Another good abstract design thing about this game is that the game constantly develops towards an endpoint, usually.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, because even if you just build up immediately to get that third tower, then you have to build another tower up to two levels high. And as you're doing that, it means that there's now more spaces that can be turned into a level 3 tower. And so, like, even if you keep capping towers, eventually the game will end because you're still building up a larger area. Oftentimes, just because also you're building up walls where your opponent can't move through, like you said.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you know, generally you don't want the game to end in a draw, because that doesn't always feel fun for the players. it's one thing to lose and then at least learn something, but it's also another thing for like both players to not have won, so it feels like a waste. Mm-hmm. Which I know some people don't have, but some people do. Anyways, but the problem is like,
you definitely don't want the first few games to be draws.
Right.
Like, I think at the highest level of play, lots of abstract games become draws.
Right. It's more so like, yeah, like, you want, like, the most basic gameplay loop to eventually end in a victory for somebody.
Yeah.
Because, like, you know, if both players are just kind of meandering and building up towers, however, eventually somebody will get to the point where there's a critical mass of second level towers. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of what I'm getting at, is it's good for games to encourage that as far as, like, abstract games. Because, like, in chess, eventually there will be a point where a piece has to capture another piece. Just because, you know, you can't move everything else.
Right.
Theoretically, at least. Or, like, in Go, eventually there will be a point where you end up surrounding a territory anyways. So it's just a natural way to make the game move on.
Yeah.
So
I just have one last note, and that is that the game does force the constant evolution of strategy, or at least the first evolution of strategy, just based on the fact that if both players build their towers independent of one another, the first player will win.
Yeah.
You know, because that's true, that sort of kicks off the whole process.
Yeah. And that's a realization that at least one player will have after the first game, because mm-hmm. it's the player that doesn't go first.
Of course, yeah. If two people just don't think of any strategy and build their towers independently, the first player the first player could just win, and then both players will be like, oh, you just win, and I just lose, so what do I do?
Yeah.
And I mean, the game has it right there in the rule book. You cap it. It has a rule for it. It doesn't tell you that capping is a very powerful thing that will offset the tempo of the game. It just says like, hey, you can cap a tower.
Right.
It's just, and then when somebody does that, they'll say like, oh, this is very powerful.
Yeah. And then I do have another sort of design concept, which is how the gods are designed. Mm-hmm. So, like, you mentioned different categories of them earlier, you know, right, like just extra to go through builds, those again. Movement restrictions, displacing opponents, removing pieces or workers, and alternate win conditions.
Mm-hmm.
So with an abstract game, they kind of intentionally have only a few rules, so you would think it would be hard to come up with that many knobs to turn for something like variable powers. Knobs, of course, being like an element of the game that you can slightly adjust to make different effects.
Mm-hmm. Like, even just thinking about it, like adding extra moves and builds, like that seems like a very risky knob to fiddle with.
And even then, like, how do you make it so that one given build another block is different from another build another block?
Yeah.
You know, how do you make them feel unique? And I think, for one thing, by categorizing these into, you know, different categories, not just extra moves and builds and all that, but like, you know, extra movement, extra builds, stuff like that. It does sort of create knobs that way and helps look at all the different pieces that can be switched up, like how mm-hmm. to win, how you move, how you interact with your opponent's workers, stuff like that. But also, by making some of them offensive, some of them defensive, some of them proactive, and some of them reactive, you're able to switch around. You're able to, like, invent a new knob just by doing that. So, like, how offensive your extra builds are versus how defensive they are. So, mm-hmm. like Atlas is, it changes how you build pieces, but it's mostly defensive, or, like, reactive. Mm-hmm. Whereas, like Poseidon or Hephaestus or Demeter both have pretty proactive extra builds that are personally like developmental. They're good for you, so they threaten to win sooner.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's like things that remove your opponent's pieces that are proactive, like Bia, or things that move your opponent's pieces that are more reactive, like, where was it? The Minotaur. So, like, what I'm saying is, instead of just having knobs that are the mechanics, there's knobs that are when these happen or what their usage is. Mm-hmm. So by, like, having this scale of, like, how it affects you versus your opponent and how proactive or reactive it is, you can, like, quadruple the number of individual possible gods. If you think of them as a grid of all possible combinations.
Mm-hmm. And just in terms of balance, if extra moves and builds seem powerful, you just got to make sure that all the other abilities are just as powerful as if you could build twice on your turn.
Yeah. There is one problem I have with this game, which is kind of minor. It's that, so the game comes with this setup board thing where it's like ocean and then sort of like these cliffs that elevate the main board. And then the main board is on top. This comes out to maybe like an inch and a half tall. I don't know how many centimeters, sorry. But it has this thing where, like, it's elevated just enough that it becomes a little too easy to, for workers to get hidden behind two-story towers.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it kind of had to crane my neck around sometimes to see every worker on the board, especially in three-player games where there's six workers.
Now, functionally, you can rotate the board, and it doesn't change the game at all. It's a rotationally symmetrical board, and you know, there's nothing that cares about direction like in checkers or chess.
Yeah.
But the pieces also are kind of light, and there's not a lot of friction between the plastic pieces and the coated board, so they can slide around sort of easily. They can also slide around sort of easily if you're trying to reach in between a couple towers to pluck out your worker.
Yeah, if I played it again recently, I would want to try it with just the board being flat on the table.
Yeah, without the plastic elevated thing.
Which looks cool, it's just a little impractical.
Yeah. Alright, do you have anything else to say about... the art style is really great. The components, despite their slidey nature, they're very high quality sculpts. They interlock with each other nicely to make the towers, so the towers won't ever fall over or fall apart. They'll just slightly shift a little bit on the grid.
Yeah.
All the artwork for the gods is very, very cool and stylized and is very consistent.
Yeah.
And the graphic design is good too. And I like the rule book. Most of the rules, I mean, it's a simple abstract game. All the rules you're playing are in like two columns on the first page.
Yeah.
All right. So that will be the end of our episode on Santorini. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.
Similar games, Nightmare Chess is my go-to for a similar game, which is Nightmare Chess is a deck that you add to a game of chess. That will modify, you know, how certain pieces, they can upgrade pieces, they can rotate the board, they can teleport the pieces around. It's a really exciting and cool thing, and I suggest everyone check it out.
I recommend Hive, which I've already mentioned, and we did an episode on, as another abstract where you're directly building up the board in some way.
Mm-hmm. By the way, we selected this game because we mentioned it at the end of our previous episode, which was about affordable games. We tried to list a bunch of games under $20 that were, you know, a good bang for your buck. This game comes in at under 30, but if you want a game with an actual board, this is a pretty good one. All right. So if you like what you hear, you can follow us, leave us reviews on any podcasting platform. You can find us on social media at BG Bros Cast and hit us up with comments and suggestions there. If there's a game that you want to hear our thoughts on, or a concept or idea that you want to hear our thoughts on, you can submit your suggestions there. You can go to our website, bgbcast.com, where we have all of our episodes posted and tagged. So if you're looking for an episode for a particular game or concept, you can go through the tags there and hunt it down and listen to that episode. And if you can't find it, again, hit us up on social media. On our website, you can find a link to our TeePublic store. That's teepublic.com/user/BGBroscast or BGBcast, sorry. And that's where we have t-shirts with our cool logo on it. And that does it for BG Bros plugs. So let's hear from Matt plugs.
I stream on twitch.tv/twack. That is twitch.tv/twak. I stream on most weekdays from 12 p.m. Central Time to about 3 p.m. Central Time, give or take an hour. I stream competitive games, fighting games. I speedrun a game called Hob. I play just other various games, a lot of exploration-based games. So come check that out, and you can also follow me on there, as well as follow me on Twitter at MattCraigGaming, or join the Discord server in the Twitch page description to get updates on when I go live, and also get other updates, chat with me, and if you're in the Discord server, chat with other fans of the stuff that we do. And I also write articles on the BGB Cast website under the Episodes and Articles tab. I just wrote an article about a comic series I read recently that was particularly good. So I write about like writing and game design and stuff like that. So if you're interested in stuff like that, go check that out.
All right. That does it for Matt Plugs, and that does it for our episode. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week.
See ya.